Perhaps in most spiritual practices, maybe all spiritual practices, it's very important to focus on the mundane aspects of our lives. And I would say that in favor of the great exalted states that are possible, or great things that a person might be able to do in a spiritual practice, spiritual life, if a person neglects that mindfulness, compassion, attention, generosity, neglects those things in the details of their life, the little mundane details that go on all the time, then there's probably not going to be much depth in the long term in the person's spiritual life. So to look at the mundane, and often the mundane is what people overlook, either because it's boring or not so interesting or not so exalted. And so people will often, in a spiritual practice, have their sights on something much more interesting than just, you know, washing dishes or sweeping the kitchen floor or going shopping or putting clothes away in your dresser drawer, whatever the simple things might be. And the mundane thing that I wanted to talk about today, which for some people is not mundane, but I think for many people it's mundane in the sense that it's all too easily overlooked, is the body as the locus of spiritual practice, the appreciation of the physical body that we have, we are, we live in, as being really central and really important to spiritual practice. Many people live very busy lives. Many people live lives that are very much involved with their thinking, their heads, especially in this kind of area around here. And that's not necessarily bad in and of itself, except it lends itself to developing a habit of always living in your head, always living in your thoughts and inhabiting your thinking and negotiating life all through the complicated mazes of our various thoughts and thinking. And if your whole day at work, for example, is spent that way, then it's very hard sometimes to disengage from that, but rather those kind of tracks are well greased and oiled, and the mind will all too easily slip into thinking some more. And so we think about our lives, and we think about our relationships, and we even think about our body. And a lot of the suffering that people have in relationship to their bodies occurs in the ways in which we think about our body. We objectified the body, we created it into an object, and we're actually living in our thoughts about the body, and we suffer because of it. We have a body which we think is has too much of this or too little of that, and so therefore we suffer. And these ideas of too much and too little, or whatever it might be, the ideas we have are often very much culturally conditioned. We buy them in from our society around us, and then we carry these ideas, and through the filter of these ideas, we look down at our own body and say, well, this is not the way it should be. And most people in our culture, at some point or other in their lives, I think, have had some suffering in relationship to their body, too much or too little of something or other, or just not the right way, too blonde, not blonde enough, or whatever it might be. And so we live in this world of aboutness, objectifying the body. And what is very useful to do in a spiritual life is to drop out of the objectification of our lives into what could be kind of tentatively called a subjective experience of our life, the subjective experience of our body. And that tends to be very different than the ideas that we see the body through. But rather, subjective experience of the body is how do we actually experience the body in and of itself? How's the body experiencing itself? Now, that can seem so mundane and so uninteresting because the body as it experiences itself is not part of our thinking world, not part of the ideas of ambition or progress or getting things in life that we want, avoiding things, fantasizing, negotiating, all the kind of ways in which the mind is kind of involved all the time with thoughts. Often, for some people, the whole mental world of justification, of logic, of rationalization, of fantasy, of planning, of remembering, are often very dramatic ways of avoiding paying attention to what's actually going on in our lived experience in the moment, our subjective experience of being in a body and feeling it. And to drop down into subjective experience of the body, if you really get a sense of how to do that and get some familiarity, some commitment to doing that, you'll find the body is a process. It's constantly in motion, constantly changing. And I think all of us know that. I mean, that's not news to any of us. Except for many people, the suffering we have about our body and the image many of us have for our body is often fixated. This is who I am in a kind of solid way. I'm this way. And our culture often reinforces kind of solid body image kind of ideas of who we are. And we walk around with these images. We walk around with these ideas, kind of fixated, this is who I am. I talked to someone recently who has a lot of health problems, had health problems for some 20 years, and all kinds of difficulties, all kinds of surgeries, all kinds of odd things in the body. Its body's constantly changing. She calls herself the bionic woman. She has all these metal parts that make everything work. And strange things still happen to her body. And she looks down at her body with great equanimity and says, it's just amazing. I wake up and I'm not sure what it's going to look like. And most of us, we look up and, you know, look down at our body, if it's a little bit different, you know, we have a pimple or something, and or a little ache, you know, suddenly it's like, oh my God. And she, you know, has been going through this for 20 years, and she's, this is really fascinating. You know, she's, and it's a process which is, you know, has, she's had to give up a lot to have that equanimity. Her beautiful looks disappeared. You know, her face swells and contracts and swells and contracts, so she's full, when it swells, she's not, she doesn't have so many wrinkles, but then it, when it contracts, then she's full of wrinkles and flabby, and her eyes are popping out from the medication she takes, and her legs swell, you know, depending on the time of day, you know, big and small, and so all the kind of things, all kind of wonderful things she thought that were, she was attached to, her self-identity, she's long ago had to let go of. And luckily for her, what's replaced it with is this equanimity and this kind of sense of curiosity and fascination. It's, wow, this body's doing these amazing things. So for her, it's kind of dramatic, the changing processes of her body. But our bodies are in process all the time. And one of the first fundamental mindfulness or vipassana exercises that's classically taught in Southeast Asia and Thailand and Burma is the vipassana practice of paying attention to the elements of the body. And the elements of the body, especially the four great elements, or the five elements or six elements, depending on the system, is a practice of learning how to notice how moment to moment the body is a process. The body is constantly in motion, and there's nothing in our experience which is fixed. The only thing in our body which is fixed is our concepts and ideas which fixate it. And so the first, that kind of basic fundamental exercise for many people in Vipassana is to pay attention to this, the changing processes of hardness and softness, of heat and coolness, temperature, of movement in the body, fluidity, the four elements, earth, air, fire, and water. Water is considered to be kind of hard to feel, but you know, you feel your saliva in your mouth, things like that. And to find out that in your body, if you really pay careful, sensitive attention, you won't find anything which is staying permanent or staying unchanging. And this begins to loosen up the ideas we have that the body is fixated, fixed in some kind of ways, permanent in some kind of way. And it's very, very helpful to begin softening the categories by which we hold ourselves by. And this is a very big part of what mindfulness practice is helping us to do, is to soften, tenderize, loosen up the fixed categories through which we see our life. And rather than seeing our lives through categories, can it's possible to live through a life, to live in a lived life, an experienced life of the body. When I first started doing meditation practice, I thought the body was kind of a nuisance. And I thought the body was kind of something you just had to bully it around to get it to do what I wanted to do. And I had this idea that it was basically my body was in the way. You know, if my knees were too tight, I couldn't get them down, or my legs would fall asleep, or my back just wouldn't stop hurting, or, you know, or mostly it was my knees. I remember just burning all the time. And if only my knees stopped burning, then I could really be a spiritual person. Then I could really, you know, then I could do it right. You know, and many people have this idea, if only mind, if only something's not this way. So I thought the body was just a thing you kind of plop down, and meditation practice was mostly what you do with your mind, which is how it also, I think, many people associated with settling the mind, making the mind peaceful, calming the mind. But I think it's very useful to switch the way we look at meditation and look at it as rather than being those things, as being a settling of the body, a calming of the body, bringing peace to the body. And in fact, what I discovered through my practice and what many people discover is a very important part of a regular, ongoing sitting practice of meditation is the settling of the body that happens. The body begins to change. The body begins to loosen itself up. And it's almost like a yogic thing. Put yourself in a yogic posture and the body will begin adapting to that posture. But the adaptation that happens in the sitting posture is not the adaptation of kind of molding yourself into a new body, but rather is allowing all the fixated ways in which we hold our body to relax. So if I go to work every day and fear is an element of my job, my stomach might be just a little bit contracted, my shoulders a little bit up, and it might be a very, very little amount. But it gets compounded through the day. And it never has a chance to relax because it's day after day. And if you have enough anxiety about work, maybe it's through the weekends also, if you take the weekends off. And so these very, what can be very subtle, like very, very gross, little tensions of fear begin becoming, become a habit in the body. And so the body then, out of the habit, stays tense. The stomach stays tense, the shoulders stays tense. And the small little movements of this that have no chance to relax can build and build and build over a lifetime, over many lives. What, I think it was Abraham Lincoln who said, by the time a man, or I think he said a man, but by the time a person is 40, they're responsible for their face. The Buddha said it a little bit differently. The Buddha said that our lived experience of the body, our subjective experience of our body, is a result of our past motivations, actions, intentions, our past ways in which we've chosen to react and respond to the world. And you can see that in this way I'm talking about, the way we hold ourselves, our tension, the fears we have, the anxiety, the ways we use our face, the way we use, you know, our whole posture. I think it's interesting that the English word posture means both the physical posture we take when we stand or sit or whatever, but it also means, when we posture it, you know, around other people, like at work, we're posturing for status or posturing for position or for attention. There's an attitude that gets carried in our body, in the way we hold our body. And you can look around, maybe not right now make each other self-conscious, but you can look around in different people in public situation, whatever, and study their posture, how they sit, how they walk, and it'll tell you a lot about that person. Some people are withdrawn, you know, and they can see in the way they sit how withdrawn they are, and how cynical they are, or disappointed they are, or discouraged they are, how eager they are, how excited they are, how attentive they are. There's a lot of our inner attitudes about life which are expressed in our posture. And as these attitudes become regular habits, then it becomes, these habits get kind of frozen in our body. And what happens in the early stages of practice, of a regular ongoing meditation practice, is that the habits of body holding begin to relax and the body begins to settle. And partly also there's stretching that goes on, kind of the hamstrings, and not necessarily hamstrings, but I guess some of the muscles and the ligaments in the legs begin to stretch and becomes easier to sit, for example. But I think much more profoundly is that some of these holding patterns in the body get a chance to be released. As the mind begins to release itself from its anxieties and fears and posturing and attitudes towards life and feels more at ease and not trying to make something or construct something or maintain an attitude, that it begins to relax and the body begins to settle. And it's a real delight for me as a teacher to watch students, new students come and watch how they sit at the beginning and watch over the months and the years how their body begins to change as the settling begins to happen. You know how someone will come, first they might come here and they're sitting in a chair. It's fine to sit in the chair the whole time, and then at some point you might see, oh, that person's trying to sit on the floor. That's interesting. And then first they're sitting on the floor like this, you know, and they're all tight and you're like, what a struggle. And slowly you begin seeing, slowly, you know, the knees come down, the shoulders come down, the body gets more aligned and relaxed. And it's really beautiful to see that process, the settling and letting go of the body. It is not necessarily always a pleasant process, because the ways in which we hold ourselves, the ways in which the muscles are frozen or locked in, the process of releasing that is not necessarily a movement from tightness to, you know, pleasant relaxation, but there's almost like a reluctance for the muscles to begin letting go of how they're frozen. And sometimes there's a process of actually being quite uncomfortable as the muscles begin to kind of unfreeze or begin to thaw. And so some people think, well, it's better just to stay tense then, isn't it? So forget this meditation. I don't want to relax, really. But it's actually very valuable to know that this is an important part of the process of meditation, is the settling of the body, and to allow yourself to go through some of this physical discomfort that can arise as this process goes on. I think the more we appreciate the settling of the body as part of the process, the more patient we can be with the difficulty of that process. And the end result, I think, is a body which is very comfortable in itself. I think many people don't have bodies in which they're comfortable in themselves. They're only comfortable if they're kind of leaning against a couch or slouching or leaning against some backrest, or even if they're standing, maybe they're leaning against this door frame, or they're, you know, there are all kinds of ways in which we hold our body which are reactions to not being settled on ourselves. But to discover the possibility of being settled in the body, so our posture, our attitude, our holding patterns in the body are not in reaction to anything, but just settled on itself. So part of that process is certainly appreciating the importance of the body, but appreciating the importance of the subjective body, of what the body feels like in and of itself, to sense and feel the body from the inside. Or another way of saying this, perhaps, is to give up control or give up your ideas of what you're supposed to pay attention to, and sometimes ask yourself, what is it in my body that's asking for attention? Is there something in my body that wants attention right now? And then bring your awareness to that part of your body and hang out there, be with that. And sometimes it's very obvious what wants attention because it's burning. And sometimes maybe it's not so obvious. It may be very subtle, but you get a sense something's kind of calling your attention, saying, here, bring your attention here. Be in the present moment here for this kind of experience in the body. Sometimes when I'm feeling a little bit discouraged or a little bit frustrated or very frustrated, whatever, I notice that certain parts of my body that might not be very loud are calling my attention to them. Sometimes like a little band across my chest here of tightness or expansiveness or tautness that might be here. That seems very, very connected to the sense of frustration. And so I listen very carefully and I bring my attention to that part of my body, this little band of tightness. Just hang out there until something happens and it loosens itself up and changes. I talked to someone yesterday who I knew some 20 years ago or more, and back then was a devoted practitioner of Aikido. And So I haven't seen her much over the years. So I asked her, I think she's getting close to 50 now, maybe she's 50 years old. And I asked her if she's still doing Aikido. And she said, no, she doesn't do it anymore. And then she went on, she gave a kind of series of justifications why she's not doing it anymore, and including that she said Aikido is difficult for an older body because of being thrown on the floor a lot, she claimed. And she went on to say that one of the great practitioners in San Francisco back 20 years ago, recently, was a 79-year-old woman who was 5 foot tall. It seemed a little bit contradiction there. But that wasn't the point. The point I wanted to say was that what she does instead is periodically she turns on, she goes into her living room and turns on her stereo and some nice music, and she just begins to move. And she'll move for an hour. And she's learned that her body knows how it should move. And she just listens to her body. What is the body? How does the body want to move here? And she listens to that, and she moves. And after an hour of doing that, she says, it's as good as doing, you know, my old Aikido. It just does wonderful things for me and my body and settles me. And but this phrase that she used, you know, my body knows what to do. My body knows how to move. And so to get out of the way and allow the body to move itself, for example, in dance. To do that in meditation, we don't necessarily move in meditation, but a kind of similar process happens there where we allow the attention to go through the body, and the attention, the awareness we place in different parts of our body is what begins to free up the body. It's really remarkable, and it gives you a tremendous confidence to begin to have that experience, that to bring attention to something begins to free it to some degree in the body. It's kind of like if you bring attention to some part of your body, or actually to anything in your life, in your subjective experience of life, you'll find it that it's kind of like experience you've given more space in which it can move. And when it can move, it can begin to unravel or dissolve, or resolve itself. So the Buddha said that not our kind of abstract physical body, but the body that we sense, the body that we feel from the inside, is the result of our past karma, of our past intentions, intentional reactions to life. And so that's really obvious, I think, for a person when they're a beginning meditator. If you get a sense of how, you know, you start discovering what your body feels like, what it's like to be in a body, and you get a sense of maybe why it's that way, and you begin having experience of the body beginning to relax itself and release itself, and discovering a different body. As a person becomes aware of the subjective nature of the body, the subjective experience of the body, as opposed to objective ideas we have of it, you begin finding actually there's just, you can have many bodies. It isn't just have one body that you have. There's the body of fear. There's the body of what it feels like when you're filled with fear. The body of peace. The body of generosity, the body of love. There's certain bodies that seem to get generated in the process of meditation itself, especially with meditation that involves a lot of concentration. There's a body that there's a body that's sometimes called the adamantine body, the diamond body, when the body seems to kind of get very alert, very strong, the spine kind of locks into position. And this tremendous vitality and power that kind of seems to rot, kind of, that happens with concentration. And when I've had that experience, I described it as being leaving the karmic body, leaving the habit body behind for a short while. Like all these ways in which I habitually hold myself through my attitudes and reactions to life or whatever, with enough concentration and peace in the mind, are let go of, even sometimes just temporarily, and the body kind of leaves it behind, kind of it just kind of sloughs off for a while, and this more adamantine or diamond body then appears. So it's kind of weird to talk this way, but if you understand it, what we're talking about is our subjective experience, not necessarily what a physiologist or a scientist would say. So to settle our body on itself, to give our body a chance to settle itself. That's why one of the reasons why I stress, if it's possible for a person, not to use the backrest when they sit in the chair. Some people have to use a backrest, and it's fine to use a backrest. Some people do their meditation laying down if they need to for back reasons. And maybe it's a little bit, you know, we don't want to make people feel bad about how they are by any means. But there is some advantages if your health of your spine or whatever allows it, of not using the backrest. There is some advantages sitting on the floor. And they are that it really helps this process of the body settling itself. If a person can take a posture which is as aligned as possible along gravity, then gravity can help you relax. If the body is, if a person is always using a backrest and leaning back, I know some people always meditate on their couch, but if you're always leaning back and resting like this, you know, back against the backrest, the shoulders themselves don't actually have much movement to relax, to settle down, or the shoulder blades in the back can't actually settle back very far. But if you're sitting up like this, then there's actually more opportunity for the shoulders and the shoulder blades to relax. If you're also sitting like this, kind of scrunched over here in your stomach, it's actually a little bit hard for some of the tightness of the tension in the stomach to relax itself, because there's no movement, no space for relaxation to happen. But if a person's sitting upright in a balanced, aligned way, then the stomach can hang out and relax, and all the habitual ways we hold our stomach can also release itself and relax. Same thing with the chest, you know, all kinds of parts of our body. The body also I find a tremendous source of. I like to use the word wisdom, source of wisdom, tremendous source of information about how we are living our lives, how we're reacting, what our feelings are, what our reactions are. And as we learn to be more trustful of life and learn not to always be manipulating life or wanting things to be a certain way or fixing things and kind of are always afraid of things and always defending ourselves or always being on the offensive or whatever we do, and just kind of be more open and present and uncontrolling, the wisdom of insecurity, just open and present for life as it is. Part of what makes it safe to do that is being really sensitive to what goes on in our inner lives. And the body is the window to that, I find, a tremendously powerful window to that. To be open to the present moment and not be defensive, but then be sensitive to the subtle cues in the body when the body feels apprehensive. There's a huge difference between the body feeling apprehensive and our mind feeling apprehensive, if I can talk that way. So the body sometimes it picks up more tangible or more important cues than the mind, because the mind is often connected to our self-image, connected to our habitual memories of past experiences. It's connected to the acquired ideas we have about how we approach life and what life is about. And so we have all these filter of ideas in our mind, some of them which are quite wrong. Many people have completely erroneous ideas about what life is. Some people feel that life is always a competition. Some people feel life is always out to get them. Some people feel that they always have to be defensive. Some people feel there's many attitudes people have which are, you know, to have them as absolute stances or postures about life are wrong. So if our fear and anxiety arises through the filter of those ideas, you know, we just add to our suffering. But to experience our fear or apprehension through our body sometimes is much more accurate. The body isn't filtering it through all these ideas often. So I don't know if this was a useful way of talking about it, but the body itself provides a lot of important information for you if you stay sensitive to it, that allows you to let go of control. What do you think of that? You'll learn what you need to know. So there are times in my life when I can. I'm not going to that. So that's all I'm going to say for tonight. And give you a chance to respond or ask questions or please.
Yeah, this question involves Goenka and the body. So I think this question probably, your answer would probably be another whole evening. But he, from my understanding, he feels that his form of Vipassana was handed down from Buddha directly. And you might have a different idea on that. And I'm just wondering, how do you feel about his focus on the body as far as the means to enlightenment versus this version of Vipassana?
I think they're both great. They're different, but they're both great.
Do you think that perhaps maybe one might be more suitable to a particular person, another to another version of Vipassana, maybe to another type of person?
I think so. I think that's true. It's a different period, different phases in a person's life, or phases in one's practice. Different ways of practicing Vipassana might be useful. I occasionally will ask someone or suggest someone they go off and do a Goenka-style practice, especially for various reasons. But if someone's practiced for a long time, sometimes it can give them kind of a new angle, a new way in, new inspiration, a new perspective. Sometimes it can kind of give a certain fire to a person that they got them complacent. Sometimes it gives them a very powerful experience of their body that they haven't had before. Sometimes it's just simply for educational. You should know, it's useful for some people to know kind of the range of how Vipassana is taught, and this is one of the ways.
What is this other kind of Vipassana?
There are many kinds of Vipassana. If you go to Southeast Asia, you find there's many different schools or lineages of Vipassana practice. If you read Jack Kornfield's book, it used to be called Living Buddhist Masters, but since only one of them is still alive, they changed the title to Recently Living. Now it's called Living Dharma. And in there, I think they maybe, I don't know if Goenka is featured, but his teacher is featured, Ubha Khin. And Goenka was a disciple of a Burmese man named Ubha Khin, who developed or came from the Buddha. As you know, all Buddhism comes from the Buddha, so that's a fine claim for anyone to make. And a practice of sweeping through the body. So in a typical Goenka retreat, he's the primary person who teaches this practice in the West. There's two major teachers in the West of this Goenka, of Ubha Khin's method. One is Goenka, and the other is Ruth Dennison. And Ruth Dennison has her own spin on it, and Goenka has a little bit of his own. But in a 10-day Goenka retreat, a person would begin by something like three days, of breath meditation in order to develop a lot of strong concentration, as strong as they can. And then once the concentration is built, after 3 days or so, then the person does a body sweep practice, where systematically the person sweeps through the body or scans the body, starting at the top of the head, feeling the sensations there on top of the head. Then they move to the forehead and feel the sensations there. Then move to the sides of the head and the nose and the face and the neck and the shoulders and the arms and the hands and the torso and the stomach and the legs. And they kind of systematically go through the body, and they go through it. Maybe the first time it takes an hour to go through it. And as they get more adept at it, they go through it faster and faster, just feeling the sensations, the subjective sensations of the body. And as the person does this, a number of things will begin happening. One is that they bring their attention to the places where there's holding in the body, fixations in the body. And just bringing attention to it begins to dissolve it, as I was talking about earlier. So it's a very powerful purifying practice, because most of the fixations we have, mental fixations or emotional fixations, have their expression somewhere in the body. And if you address things on a physical level rather than the psychological level, often the psychological level will be taken care of, more often than not. Maybe some psychologists would like to disagree with me, but which is, you know, I'm not saying I'm right here. But there's a very strong connection between the body and the mind. And some things, I think, are actually better handled, more efficiently or more easily handled, not through the, not dealing with the mind or the psychology of it, but rather addressing directly what's happening in the body and allowing the body to relax. As the body relaxes, sometimes that mental fixation will relax and the person will have a different experience of themselves. So there's a, in Gwenka practice, you talk a lot about purification, purifying the body. And it's a very powerful way of doing this. But it happens also in our practice. It's just not as systematically done. And then at some point, the person, as all the fixated holdings in the body begin disappearing, what remains is the body. Nothing stays fixed in the body, but rather what you feel is a body just vibrating. Just the whole body is a field of impermanent vibration. And this is a very important foundation for, especially the Gwenka people, but for a lot of Vipassana practices, is to have this experience of the body as a field of constant change, a vibration of impermanence. And as people get more adept at it, they go through their body quicker and quicker. Develop a tremendous concentration. So it's a very physically body-centered Vipassana practice. And it's part of the strength. So people can develop a tremendous concentration because of the narrow scope of what the practice is about. Is this at all helpful or interesting? Yes?
A related question. What I found very interesting in Gwenka's teaching is his explanation for the meaning for the importance of bodily sensations.
The importance of?
Bodily
yes. Yeah.
The fact when he is talking about the 12-link chain of dependent origination, his key point is when contact happens with the sense organs, some sensations start on the body. And then we react to these sensations. And this is the place where we can break the chain and during that practice, he trained, well, he explained to students that they should learn to remain equanimous with respect to sensations, and that would automatically will carry over to all other problems. That is, he's saying that this is the most skillful way to observe any emotion, anger, whatever you have, it's connected to some sensation, and he's saying that you cannot really observe anger, but you can observe the sensation. And what I want to ask is, if you think that there are some kinds of, I guess, experiences which are, which should be dealt with in some other ways rather than just observing the sensation. In your experience, have you found that some problems are better or more directly addressed by working with whatever, observing intentions, for example, or feelings or something like that?
Well, that's what we teach. You know, in a kind of way, the source of Vipassana practice is a discourse by the Buddha called the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, where he taught all four different areas in which we bring our attention to. And with the Gwenka, they focus primarily just on one, and it's very powerful to kind of be, you know, kind of focus just on one. In that discourse of the Buddha, he actually emphasized all four equally, and so including our feelings, our emotions, and our cognitive lives. And Gwenka tends to focus just on the first two, not just the body, but the body and the feeling tone. So I'm a little bit, feel a little bit hesitant to ask answer your question directly, because I don't want to contradict Gwenka exactly. So I'll say it this way, that there are some people who emphasize their physical experience excessively, And I haven't had this notice in many years now, but back in the 70s, when people were had a little bit help in their meditation practice. and other things. And there was people who had come back from Asia or doing long meditation, and you'd ask them, "How are you?" And they would say, "Oh, there's a lot of tightness and tension all over the body." "Oh, that's nice. But how are you feeling?" "Oh, there's a lot of tightness and tension here in my shoulder, and I feel it, and it feels tight, and hard." "Well, that's great, But how are you feeling?" "Well, now you mention it there, I feel a lot of heat also, And then you say, "Well, you seem angry to me." "Oh, really?" So it's possible to emphasize the body so much that a person is not so aware of their emotional life. That's not don't pay attention to it. I know there are some people who did a lot of Goenka practice who feel it was very important for them, have tremendous love and respect for it, who stopped doing it and started doing the kind of practice we do. And it isn't like this is the right direction, because you find people going in every possible direction all the time. So if you just say, use them as the example, then you don't want to jump to conclusions that this is the right thing. But my friends who've done a lot of Goenka practice and then come to this practice, what they've said is that for their particular experience, that it was very powerful to do the very narrow body sweeping that the Goenka practice does and focus on the body sensations, but it actually didn't help them become wise in their emotional lives and wise about their cognitive experiences. And they actually it was actually much more helpful to broaden their experience of practice to include their cognitive experience and their emotional experience, and learn how to pay attention to that beyond just paying attention to physical sensations. I think all Vipassana teachers, most of them, I hope, put tremendous stress on the importance of body sensations as a foundation for Vipassana practice. So, in that sense, it's not very similar to Goenka. The difference would be that Goenka was almost exclusive emphasis on that. And now, one of the differences is that with some teachers like Goenka, their emphasis on practice is enlightenment, enlightenment or bust. Nothing else really is important. And that's maybe a very valid approach to spiritual life, enlightenment or bust. Other teachers also might feel enlightenment is very important, but they want to do it in such a way that the person is rounded and free in all different aspects of their life, and has a broad, firm foundation for their life and for their awakening. It's possible to have some experience of enlightenment, and because the person is not well-rounded, they become more arrogant because of it and more of a nuisance for people around them. So being a little bit well-rounded sometimes is helpful, rather than, just going for the, straight and true path or something. Some people would like to see to have a practice where they find awakening or find truth or find reality in all aspects of their life. So they don't bifurcate life as this is the area of practice and this other area of my life that's not practice. When we see everything is equally valid domain of practice. And so something like the Goenka practice, which tends to be so narrowly focused, doesn't really suit them so well, because they want to be more broad and include everything. But if you're too broad and include everything, then danger of that is that you lose enlightenment, because you just kind of become kind of too casual or too relaxed. And so this is, this could be, we could talk about this topic for a long time. It's very important and interesting. But is there one more important question? Yeah.
I was going to ask until you said important.
The important question at this point in the evening would be one that would allow for a short answer. And maybe that's, you know, has to do with my wisdom more than yours.
Okay, you might be able to just give a list. I was going to ask the question he asked, but in a slightly different way. So, taking our type of practice where you have, you know, broad focus, are there certain human problems or human conditions, you know, like somebody's dealing with anger, somebody's dealing with sadness, depression, too much excitement, addiction, that lend themselves better to the Goenka stuff, and others that lend themselves better to a cognitive? You know, saying one that you would say focus on, sit and focus on your sensations for this type of thing. For this, I want you to focus on your breath and, you know, your mind, where your thoughts are going.
I don't have a list answer. You know, I think it's really individual, and I would have to, as I'm talking to people individually in their situation, I might make different recommendations. There are some people for whom I have, you know, really encouraged them to go into their body and stay in their body, and other people have said, you know, you're in your body enough. You know, you better start paying attention to what you're thinking here a little bit and know more, take more responsibility for it. One of the things that I found useful after doing many years of Buddhist practice, with a spiritual teacher who I thought, you know, I called her a therapist, but she didn't want to be called that, but it kind of looked like that. You know, you paid your money, you showed up at the office a certain time once a week, and what she taught me to do, maybe it's a standard psychotherapeutic technique, was she noticed that I had this ability to let go really quickly, and if you let go too quickly, sometimes the patterns that reappear, you don't really see the roots of them. You don't see the underlying causes of what keeps getting triggered and causing that reaction to happen. So this person told me to train me, whatever, pointed me towards hovering. I think it's a word she used. Hovering with the experience, with the anger, for example, and not like letting go of it really quickly, because I could do that, you know, but rather letting it be there and kind of. It was actually a little bit hard for me to kind of. I could be angry really well, and I could let go really well, but to kind of just hover kind of in between was something I couldn't do very well. And hovering in between then allowed me to notice the cognitive experiences, the physical, the emotional, the whole realm of it. And all these things are like a web. They're all kind of interrelated, and they're not so separate from each other. But so it's very valuable to get a sense of the whole map, the whole web, the whole interactions. And it's very valuable in Vipassana practice to see the cause and effect relationship between the mind and the body. And so if you only focus on the body, you might miss some of the causal relationship between them. So I think it's an individual thing. And as a teacher, I would kind of, you know, I listen to individuals and then I make recommendations. And it's a great question you asked, but I don't think I can answer it in a general way. So I hope that you all enjoy your body, and I hope that you will maybe spend some time now, inspired by this talk, to give up control of and let your body be your guide for where your attention should be in the present moment, and follow your body's cues and where your attention should be. And if the mind wanders off into its thoughts, whatever, come back to your body and be really interested, like a great explorer, a great discoverer of unknown territory that's undiscovered, you know. Be discoverer and kind of discover the dark places of your body and what calls from within you to for attention. And may that lead to your purification and awakening and the happiness of all beings.